Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to After Dark. I'm Maddie.
And I'm Anthony.
And this episode, we're heading to Whitechapel in 1888. Now, this is an episode that's been, I think it's fair to say, our most requested one. We've taken our time in getting to it, and we wanted to offer something a little bit different. So to set the scene, over to Anthony.
It's Thursday, November 8th, 1888. Walk with me now through the gloomy streets of Whitechapel in the East End of London. According to the official copy of the report issued by the Meteorological Office, the weather tonight, it is particularly stormy and wet. Even to the hardened Londoners about us, the rainfall feels excessive. On we go through these wet, busy, dirty streets then, where darkness has taken hold, and as experts have noted, bright sunshine was deficient. This darkness forewarned of a great danger that stalked these very streets. For here, on these cobbles, an unidentified serial killer, just last month the press had nicknamed Jack the Ripper, was on the loose. Now that evening, Joseph Barnett, a fish porter, met with his former partner Mary Jane Kelly at their old lodgings at 13 Miller's Court. They had a shared room until Joseph had lost his job and Mary Jane had no choice but to return to sex work to earn some money. And when Mary Jane started bringing other sex workers back to these rooms too, Joseph felt he had to move on. That night, Joseph left Mary Jane's company at about 8 p.m. Often when they parted, he'd give her a few shillings to keep her going, but that night he had nothing to give. Then, at 12:30 a.m, Mary Jane Kelly was next seen at the Ten Bells pub with her friend Elizabeth Foster. After that, she was spotted having a drink with two others at the Horn of Plenty on Dorset Street, not far from the Ten Bells and not far from her accommodation. Now, an unemployed labourer, George Hutchinson, who knew Kelly quite well, reported that the two had met at about 2 a.m. in the morning on Flower and Dean Street and that Kelly asked him for a loan of sixpence. He later stated that as Kelly walked in the direction of Thrall Street, she was approached by a man of, quote, Jewish appearance and aged about 34 or 35. Hutchinson claimed he was suspicious of this man because although Kelly seemed to know him, this individual's opulent appearance made him an unlikely character to be in that particular neighbourhood. These are the last known sightings of Mary Jane Kelly. But she must have made her way back to 13 Miller's Court at some point because the next time she was seen was there just before noon on the 9th of November 1888 by her landlord's assistant, Thomas Bower. Mary Jane's customary rebellious tenacity, her intelligence and her resourcefulness had all been robbed, however. Her lifeless, unrecognisable body lay on her bed, the final canonical victim of Jack the Ripper. The cause of her death was recorded as hemorrhage due to severance of the carotid artery. She now rests, finally at peace, in St. Patrick's Roman Catholic Cemetery in Leytonstone, London.
Lots to unpack in that opening, but let's talk about the Jack the Ripper case more generally, because it's something that people, when we've invited listeners to write in and give us suggestions for episodes they'd like to hear, it's an episode that we get requested a significant amount, possibly more than anything else, because it's still very much alive in people's imaginations. And I think it's fair to say in the historical conversation that we're still having about the Victorian period, about violence against women, about how we tell history, how we deal with historic misogyny. We must mention, I think up front, the very famous work by Halle Reubenhold that's really myth-busted a lot of the history or so-called history around the Jack the Ripper case. We're talking about The Five, of course, which I think for me is a book that I find hugely inspiring as a historian, as a reader, as a female reader. And it's something that I often return to, actually. I've read it multiple times. There's so much history that's been told, and I think there's still things to say. And it took us a while to come to this episode, didn't it? Because we were thinking, what do we want to say about this case? How can we say something new? How can we look at it from a new angle? We want to deal with the horrendous violence of the crime, because I do think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, violence against women is something that has happened in the past and continues to happen today. And I don't want to look away from it. But also, we want to bring the lives of the women who were the victims of so-called Jack the Ripper to the fore as well. And how do we respect that? And so the conversation that we're going to have today is really building on a lot of that foundation, I think.
And it's also asking another question, which is really pertinent to our time. Turns out it's not pertinent to our time exclusively. We think it is. We've covered this in After Dark before. But why does this and many other cases like it fascinate us so much, number one? And number two, how do we approach these histories? How do we tell these histories, as you mentioned when you were talking initially?
Because people have been telling this specific history since day one, since the first victim's body was discovered.
Yeah. So it's grappling with some of those things.
There's a whole industry. There's a Jack the Ripper industry that's very much still making money.
Yeah. But then we have to own up to the fact that this conversation is part of that too. The only thing that we have to possibly try and do is do that responsibly. And because, as you say, it's important that these types of histories are told, because they're worthwhile histories. And they're also histories we would not necessarily encounter in another context because of the types of people that they involve and the types of people and archives that we meet. So often working class, although not exclusively, much due to Halle Reubenhold's work. So today we want to, yes, we're going to do a little bit of a recap of what this case was, because potentially some people may not know, although I'd say most people are familiar. But we're also going to talk about the storm it caused at the time in the media and how it was told and how people in 1888 and 1889 immediately exploited it. And that's what we hope we can offer to this conversation. It was immediate. It was straight away. It's not unique to our time.
Before we look at the media attention around the case, let's just get our bearings a little bit. So you've set the scene wonderfully in Whitechapel in the East End of London. And it's an area today that if you walk around sort of Brick Lane, expanding outwards into that area, that it feels very historic still. It's a place that you can go and walk and you can really immerse yourself. And of course, Jack the Ripper walking tours are a huge part of the industry we've been talking about. But in 1888, give us a little bit of context. What's happening in Britain? What's happening in London, in Whitechapel in particular? What's the atmosphere like?
So as we know, Queen Victoria is on the throne. That's a real iconic part of this Victorian history. This is very much a Victorian history. And she sits on the throne as all this is unfolding. And she's aware that these events are unfolding as well. Such big news do they become. We also have, in less direct correlation to the events that are unfolding in Whitechapel, in Glasgow, we have Celtic FC, who are playing their first official match in 1888, winning 5-2 against Rangers. The London Match Girls strike of 1888 as well is interesting in the context of this.
I didn't know that was 1888. So that's a really interesting history. And we can maybe do an episode on that at some point. But these are girls, or women, working in a factory making matchsticks. And they're being poisoned, right, by the chemicals in the factory.
Yes.
And they're suffering all kinds of effects. The pay is terrible. The working conditions terrible. And they're pioneers, really, of workers' rights and women's rights.
They unionize.
They unionize and they strike against the factory owners.
Yeah, so this is really important context, I think, about what's about to unfold in our story, what's about to unfold in Whitechapel. It's also December 1888, so after the initial spate of murders by who we now recognise as Jack the Ripper, is when the infamous Vincent van Gogh ear-chopping off incident also occurs.
Okay. Not in Britain.
No. But it's an iconic piece of, again, gruesome history, though. You know, it's not exactly like that's a light subject either.
In 1889, so a year after the murders, the Women's Franchise League is founded. They have their first meeting. And this is really the start of what becomes the suffragette movement, mm-hmm. the campaign for women to get the vote, first of all, amongst, you know, many other rights. And just thinking about the Matchstick Girls there as well, there's an atmosphere, obviously, in the 1880s. Women are starting to look at their lives differently, for the whole of time they've been asking questions and demanding better things, but they're starting to do that in a formalized way that's legitimized through setting up a league, an institution, using the language of the society they're in to empower themselves. And of course, trying to get the vote is very much part of that. So that's the context for some of the things that are going on in women's lives, some women's lives in Britain in this moment. But let's get into the basics of the case and let's hear a little bit more about the women themselves who are killed, because we're not necessarily going to speculate a huge amount on who Jack the Ripper was.
We'd waste our time, wouldn't we?
We'd waste our time, and let's not give whoever he was any more airtime than he's already had, I think is fair to say. So tell me a little bit about these victims. And I suppose the first thing maybe to mention here is that canonically, until Hallie Reubenhold's work at least, it's been understood that they were all sex workers working in the East End of London. And she's very much myth-busted that straight away. One or two of them had sold sex, had been in that situation. But the routes that each of these women take are quite different into the moment of being in the East End and their deaths, when they meet their deaths. Let's hear about Mary Jane Kelly first, because she's the woman that we hear about in the opening of the episode. So tell me a little bit about her.
So Mary Jane Kelly is the last of the five canonical victims of Jack the Ripper.
And there are arguments to be made that there are other victims, potentially.
Yes, yeah. Some people would argue that there's others. So we're in the East End of London, Whitechapel specifically. It's autumn 1888. And I think it's important to realise that this is not out of the blue. There is constant violence against women happening in this particular location and in other locations across London and Britain and across the world, of course.
And most of that meted out by men they are in intimate relationships with, either sexual relationships or men in their family, right?
Yes, yeah. And so we have this context happening in the background. However, the first victim, Marianne Nichols, is a rather shocking case because the bodies of these women are found in very public areas. They are discovered by members of the public or, in some cases, police officers. We're not going to go into details. That's not the point of this episode. But the brutality that's been exacted upon them is so shocking, even in the context of the wider brutality that's being meted out against women, that it makes headline news across the world. This is not something that later becomes huge in the 20th century. No. In the 19th century, in 1888, and we'll discover this as we go on, this is filling the newspapers, this is the talk of the town, there is fear, there is palpable fear, and yet there are people who are still going about their daily lives with all of this happening around them. And we are looking at women who have, regardless of their backgrounds, and as you say, not necessarily all of them involved in sex work, but all of them in some way engaged in poverty at this point in their lives. They weren't all from working class backgrounds either, it's important to say. But at this point in their lives, they are down on their luck often, and they are struggling with maybe addiction, or they are homeless to a certain extent, and they find themselves in this part of London because that's where a lot of that working poor or even homeless poor are around this time. So that's the general world that we're entering into here.
So you mentioned Marianne Nichols there as the first victim. Then we have Annie Chapman, then Elizabeth Stride, then Catherine Eddowes, and then we have Mary Jane Kelly as supposedly the final victim. Tell me a little bit about her, because she's from Ireland, right?
Is she from Ireland? This is one of the things I find really fascinating about her and really intriguing about her, because I think she is. So apparently she's from Limerick. She was born in around 1863. So Limerick is a county in Ireland. But on her travels, as she's going through England, because it's not always London, but as she's going through England, she's leaving other stories behind too. So there's times when she says she's Welsh. Mm-hmm. There's times when there's a Liverpool is attached to her at some point as well. So she is inventing this identity for herself that we're not even 100% sure that her name is Mary Jane Kelly, because she gives other names as well. She uses, Mary comes up a lot, but she uses different surnames often. So she has these different personas, but apparently the Wales connection comes because her family moved to Wales from Ireland when she was a child. So therefore, you could understand her claiming Welsh heritage as well.
And it says something about women, working class women's identities in the 19th century. We think of the Victorian era as an era in which record keeping was presumably getting better than it had been in previous centuries. For example, the law changes about registering births and deaths in, I think, the mid-century. But even then, it's not enforced for another 20 years into the 1870s. And if you're a working class woman, especially an immigrant, if she has come over from Ireland, or indeed if she's come from Wales into England, that there's something there about movement, about shape-shifting who you are, because there's nothing fixed in stone. You don't have necessarily a place in society, or your place in society changes depending on the men around you. For example, you might, your identity might be built on your father and then on a husband or a lover and whatever it is. And that actually, in order to survive in this world, if you are poor and if you're a woman, you maybe do need to change who you are quite regularly. I'm not saying that all women in the working class were doing that, but this seems to have been the case for Mary Jane Kelly. And of course, it's not surprising that she ends up in the East End, which was, as it is today, a melting pot of all different immigrants, different cultures coming together, people from all over the world. In the 1880s, lots of my Jewish ancestors who'd come over from Germany and I think the early 19th century, and they'd come through to Edinburgh and then to Manchester, and then they'd ended up in the East End, and they were there in the 1880s at the time of these murders. You know, and they would have been just one family of many Jewish families, but also families from, you know, all over Europe, if not the world. And it seems to be a place where people could lose their identities and reinvent themselves. So it's not surprising to me that Mary Jane Kelly, who is apparently constantly reinventing herself, that she is drawn to a place like that, where there is maybe opportunity to a certain extent to survive. She's certainly not thriving. She's living in dire poverty by the time she is in Whitechapel. But it may have been circumstances, including having to reinvent herself, which had led her there.
Yeah, and she does go through, we know she goes through some actual iterations in that she marries when she's 16. So, you know, these are recorded iterations of her identity. And she marries when she's 16. Her husband is killed in a mining accident in an explosion. And that's when she leaves Wales. It's thought, things get a bit murky again. Mm-hmm. And her landlord at the time, whose agent discovered her body, like I said at the beginning, he knows that she was getting infrequent correspondence from Ireland. So that then calls into question the Welsh thing again, because there's no correspondence coming from Wales. It's coming from Ireland. So maybe her family didn't go to Wales, but she was in Wales because she married a Welshman. So, you know, we're left with a lot of questions about who she actually was. But it is thought that she was very likely from a middle-class background, very well-to-do. Her manners and her behavior and her, the way she spoke, the way she was able to conduct herself, marked her out in the context of the area that she was living in. But some of the names she went by when she was wandering around some of these places are Marie Jeanette Kelly. So she's keeping the surname there. Yeah, exactly. Fair Emma. Now, isn't this interesting? Because I'm going to say these names, but they don't all match up. They don't even, they don't sound like they're describing the same person.
Okay.
So Fair Emma would often be the type of name that a sex worker might get themselves because of their description.
I'm thinking fair-haired, pretty.
Right? Yeah, exactly. She was potentially known then as well at the same time as just Ginger. Yeah, so now we're saying, well, I'm guessing she has red hair, ginger hair. Mm-hmm. Then Dark Mary. The inference there is that she has dark hair, so the hair is changing. Mary again, obviously, and then Black Mary. This dark hair, this red hair, this fair hair.
I wonder if she is changing her appearance.
She may well be, but I think to that extent it's unlikely, given the context of this time. Not that it was impossible, because it wasn't, but that's a lot of change.
I wonder, as an alternate theory, is she maybe using these names as disguises? If she's moving around a lot, maybe she's not changing her appearance, but if she's working in the sex trade, she's renting rooms, her life is very sort of transient. Maybe she's coming into contact with people that she'd really rather not see again, mm-hmm. or that she needs to escape. Maybe she's using these different names to advertise her trade, but also to disguise herself, to cover her tracks, maybe.
I think that's definitely playing a part in this. I think the other side potentially then is names that men are imposing on her as part of the trade. We know in other accounts of sex workers from earlier in the 18th century, let's say, but this persisted into the 19th century, that there was often shorthands invented for some sex workers so that people knew what they were buying and could look for these people by reputation or by
Well,
name.
I'm thinking, as I think you are, of Harris's List, which exactly. is another London-based a catalogue, essentially, from the 18th century of sex workers. And if you were looking as a client to engage the services of a woman or indeed a man working in the sex trade, you could look through the catalogue and there'd be descriptions, names, but also descriptions of the services that they offered. And you could then send out someone to go and find them in the local area and pay them. How old is she when she dies?
So she's 25 when she dies. So she's young, you know, she's very much still at the beginning of her life in that sense, or beginning of her adult life, at least. One of the most fascinating things, and I stumbled across this when I was a teenager, just when I was looking up something for a school project, because I was doing a school project on Jack the Ripper.
Well, we can talk about that in a moment as well. The fact that most people come to this story at school age.
I was like, we can't talk about that project. I don't remember what it was about. I have no idea. But
yeah, we have it here.
I remember doing some research on that and seeing that image and just thinking how easily accessed it was, firstly.
The image of the crime scene.
The crime scene, yeah.
Is what we're talking about.
Yes, yeah. And it was of this particular case. But she is the only victim that's killed inside. So it's different to the other four canonical victims because of the location. It strays a little bit from the pattern that has gone before.
Let's talk a little bit about media representation of these killings then, because I would say most people have probably know of the existence of the crime scene photographs, and they are, unfortunately, very available online. These were photographs that were published in the newspaper at the time.
Yes, they were certainly available. Not, as far as I'm aware, Mary Jane Kelly's particular one. That would have been deemed too much. And the others
by
are
Victorian
not...
Victorian standards, which were not high.
Yeah, the others are after the post-mortem examination has been carried out, so they're a little bit more in a medical setting. So whereas the image we have of Mary Jane specifically is at the scene.
Yeah.
But instantly, like I said at the top of this, the headlines are eating this up. And you could argue that it's headlines based in fear, because this community, and it's so interesting to hear about your family being there, because imagine being caught up in that fear about going, I need to be indoors by this amount of time. Because it's a relatively small community around Whitechapel. You know, you think London, you think big, vast spaces. But actually, Whitechapel at this time is relatively small, hugely overcrowded, mind. Small alleyways and, you know, it's a place that's not vast. Mm-hmm. You're going to be coming into contact. I mean, your ancestors probably would have seen some of these women on those streets.
They may very well have passed them. Yeah, yeah. So I know that some of my ancestors who were there, and I think there were a few different families, but some of them had several daughters who were, you know, in their sort of late teens, early 20s, and presumably would have walked around in this mm-hmm. community. And there must have been a real feeling of fear. The other thing to say is, specifically with my ancestors who were Jewish, that talking about the fear and the sort of cyclone of news and reporting and rumour mongering that happens in the wake of the first killing, and certainly by the time we get to Mary Jane Kelly, is that the Jewish community in the East End are particularly demonised. Mm-hmm. We heard in the opening scene that you said that there's a figure who is Jewish looking, whatever that means, and there's huge anti-Semitism in the newspapers, in the community. And actually, I'm right in thinking that at one point a Jewish man is either arrested or certainly accused of
yes.
the murders.
Yeah.
Is let off later on.
And then there's the graffiti, of course.
And then there's
of the Jews are the men who will not be blamed for nothing, I think is that I'm paraphrasing, but it's
yeah,
something
so this
around
is
that.
A piece of chalk graffiti, and of course this is something I'm very interested in. You have to remember that the surfaces of this world that we're in the 1880s would have been just absolutely teeming with these kinds of notes. However, this note stood out in this context because someone wrote in huge letters the graffiti that you just mentioned that was, yes, anti-Semitic and was thought by the police and by the press at the time to be left maybe by Jack the Ripper, or yeah. if not accusing a Jewish man of being yes. Jack the Ripper, it's not particularly clear, but it's very much part of the canon of Jack the Ripper lore now, and it's one of the pieces of evidence that, you know, is always kind of brought up.
And because people think it's potentially more important than it was, because it was removed very quickly from the crime scene once the police arrived, because they thought that this would incite hatred towards the Jewish community that were living in that area. So
and
they wanted to get rid of it.
That is absolutely something that people by the 19th century would understand, that graffiti had a huge power to absolutely whip up mobs and to drive violence. We see it throughout the 18th century. You can buy my book to read about it. But, you know, this very much has a power out on the streets. And it's no surprise to me that the police got rid of that as quickly as possible, that it was rubbed away, washed away, and dealt with as quickly as possible. But of course, graffiti aside, there are more permanent words that are being set into press. The printing presses at this point are absolutely churning out story after story. Reporters are rushed to the scene, put on the ground, and they basically don't leave Whitechapel for several weeks, if not months, while these crimes are unfolding. And we get real facts to do with the case coming to light, but we also get this narrative that is set down in print, in newspapers, but also in police reports. So we get the idea, for example, comes in really early on in the police paperwork, that these women are all sex workers because some of them are homeless. They're killed on the street. And the assumption is that they have been killed by someone who's engaged their services in that way. There are all these kinds of narratives that come in, and they have real cultural resonance for the next 100 years. And it's something that has still persisted to date.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's this formula that starts to come into play of the character, and I'm using that word deliberately, of Jack the Ripper. He is named during this time as Jack the Ripper. There is a bit of debate amongst what is known as Ripperologists as to where that term comes from. There was a Dear Boss letter that apparently Jack himself wrote, although that's later been kind of debunked as not being from the person at all. But either way, it's appearing in the press during these murders as they're unfolding. So we already have an identity, although we don't know the true identity, but we already have a caricature of this mysterious killer.
Well, a character, I think, is Jack, to me, is a Victorian character. I mean, obviously, the reality is he was a real person who did truly horrendous things to other human beings. But he becomes larger than life immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. He takes on this mythic quality, which is one of the reasons why he endures so much, because of that character that's being created on the ground at the time.
And he's elevated while these women are described as being, by Victorian standards, the lowest of the low.
Well, let's take a look at that, actually, because the Telegraph at the time described Mary Jane Kelly, and after she had been killed, and this is how they described her. They said, "The poor woman who had been foully done to death was by no means among the lowest of her fallen class." Fallen being interesting there, because they don't necessarily mean poor. They mean they're associating sex work here, where they're saying that she has fallen.
Yeah, and the word fallen also insinuating fault.
Like, oh, absolutely. Yeah. Her partner, they say, was in, they don't say the word partner, I'm putting mm-hmm. that in there, was employed about the fish and fruit markets. And when the work was plentiful, the pair seemed to have paid their way honorably. So now we're looking at the working poor. Even if we think that Mary Jane Kelly may have come from a middling background, at least for some of the time when she's in London, she is identified as part of the respectable working poor. I mean, that respectability has been
and
put on them.
The insinuation there that it's because she is with in a relationship with a man that she's respectable. They team up and have this respectability together, but that she has fallen even lower by the time she's killed.
Yes.
And it's, according to the Telegraph in 1888, that it's really her fault. Something's happened in her life.
Yeah.
She's messed up.
Well, and this is what has happened. It goes on to say, but earnings were often irregular, and then it was feared that the woman resorted to the streets. So that is as blatantly as you can in a 19th century newspaper saying she was selling sex, mm-hmm. basically. So yes, they're saying, well, they're almost implying what else could you expect if you're selling sex? But this whole newspaper industry is seriously growing at this time, like mm-hmm. hugely so. I mean, the Star, I think, had a circulation of 300,000 copies a day, which is, you know, that's really big. Yeah, at the time. So people are consuming these things. The mm-hmm. Illustrated Police News, which we're going to talk about in a minute, because mm-hmm. that has...
And that's a huge driving force in this case.
Yes, and has left us with a lot of the imagery that is invented based on the crime scenes, but invented nonetheless. But that was founded in 1864, so we're talking 20 plus years before this case. And it was the first and most long-lasting Saturday penny newspaper that was giving hugely popular Victorian invented scenarios, but based in kernels of truth as well. Mm-hmm. So we have this idea, again, of true crime coming through and how true crime is being manipulated. George Perkis, who was the founder, was already specialized in the publication of this true crime stories. So he's now bringing that demand together into this particular.
So this is a genre thing. That very, I mean, we've seen it being born in the 18th century, certainly by the early 19th century. Think of the Red Barn murder, for example. Like, this is big business already. And the industry is just ready and poised to go when the Jack the Ripper killings happen. One thing that I find so interesting thinking about the Illustrated Police News is just the absolute sensationalizing of every element of the case, not just the crime scene, not just the murders themselves, the discovery of the bodies, all of that high theatre as it's presented in the papers. But also things like the reception in the local area. So they report, for example, I think this is of Mary Jane Kelly's funeral, the moment that she's buried. And it describes almost hysteria out on the streets. It says, men and women struggled desperately to touch the coffin. Women with faces streaming with tears cried out, God forgive her. And every man's head was bared in a token of sympathy. The sight was quite remarkable and the emotion natural and unconstrained. And I think this is so interesting because it gives this heightened sense of emotion, but it also has a sentimentality about the working class mm-hmm. that they're saying, the women are saying, God forgive her, i.e. she's been selling sex, she's a sinner, not how terrible that she's been murdered, but she sunk so low, look what happened to her as a result. Mm. And the men bowing their head in a token of sympathy. It's a sort of gentlemanly gesture mm-hmm. to a woman who, by the Illustrated Police News standards, is below them.
Yeah,
forgive you for what you've done.
Yeah, despite how bad you were, you didn't deserve this, of course.
Yeah, like they concede this has gone quite far.
Yes.
But it is also kind of your fault that you were in this situation.
Having fallen.
Yeah.
So let's take a look at one of the covers. Now, I will preface this by saying, this is the cover of the Illustrated Police News from, where are we? Saturday, October 27th, 1888. So this is right in the middle as this is all unfolding. Mm-hmm. And it's priced at a penny. So I think that's important because we're saying that this piece of literature has a mass appeal. It is for a mass audience. They want this to be purchased far and wide. This is not an exclusive thing. Mm-hmm. So let's establish that going into it. The other thing to say before we start describing what we're seeing is that these are not accurate descriptions of the crime scenes or the women or who people perceive to be Jack the Ripper. It is an invention based on some of the material, yes, that's coming out in, let's say, some of the more credible newspapers, shall we, or through some of the police contacts that they may have. But it is not an accurate description of what's necessarily happening. There's imaginings going on here, very, very purposefully so. And the other thing to say in terms of the context of this front page is that Jack the Ripper, although it is the biggest headline and it's taking up the most space by far, it is not the only murder that's on the front page of this. So we're in a genre, very much.
We're in a genre. So this is, yeah, the front page of the police news, and we've got the words, the Illustrated Police News, police and news, big block letters at the top, as you would expect. And this is the era, for anyone who gets frustrated by this in period dramas, this is the era where you start to get the newspaper name in really big letters.
Yes.
And sometimes the headlines in big letters, you don't get that in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. I'm not really a stickler for accuracy in period drama, but that one,
that's the one
really
we can get,
gets me. Right, the important thing to say about the police news as well, we've said it's cheap and that it's for everyone to buy. It's absolutely for the masses. These are pictures, not words. There are words in the pictures,
yeah,
but these are images. Most on the front images. Page. Think about the literacy levels in the 19th century and the people, particularly amongst the community, the people who could afford this. They're growing all the time, but they are low. So there's that to bear in mind. There's many, many images here, all in kind of little windows and
boxes.
Quite
overwhelming, actually.
It is. It's really busy.
A lot, yeah.
It's a real exciting promise,
yes,
of all this action, these incredible stories. So at the top, almost like a cartoon strip, I think, is how you'd describe it. In the top, we actually have another news story, which is, says, sketches of the Tunbridge Wells crimes. And as you say, Anthony, that's taking up a much smaller part of the front page, and the rest is dedicated to Jack the Ripper. But it shows something of the news cycle.
Yeah.
You think maybe the previous issue, the Tunbridge Wells crimes, was the big feature.
On another day.
Exactly. And so you get a sense of the sensationalization of all crimes, and that it is really a sort of merry-go-round of stories. So if we move down to the main section, which is all about Jack the Ripper, we have got, I mean, there are so many scenes, I can't even count them. One of the biggest figures in the centre is a man wearing a bowler hat and a suit. And underneath him, it says, Jack the Ripper, as described by Miss Packer and others. So this is, straight away, we are confronted with a version of Jack the Ripper.
From the time as well.
From the time, based on descriptions of real people in that area, supposedly having seen him out and about. So we have this character straight away that we can get behind.
And it's not who we envisage when we think of Jack the Ripper, because our character has evolved from this.
Yes, and I think the thing to say here, I mean, he's got a mustache, he's got a bowler hat on, he looks respectable, he's dressed very neatly, he looks like he's maybe from the sort of upper working class or lower middle in this period. He looks like any other man out on the street.
Exactly.
And
that's
I think that's the terror. That's the terror.
Yeah.
He doesn't look necessarily like the sort of gothic monster that you'd expect.
We
and we get that later on, but it's interesting here that he is more generic. And then around him, there's all the different scenes. What I will say about this is that the police are in most of these scenes.
Yes.
I mean, this is the Illustrated Police News.
Yeah, yeah.
But the story very much here is, you know, the good old police are going out onto the streets, speaking to people. There's a gentleman just below Jack the Ripper who is on the beat talking to some women in doorways, asking them questions. Have they seen anything? On the left of that, we've got a scene with a man. I think he's in a butcher's. And underneath that, it says, the mysterious man with the black bag. So there's basically this idea that people are seeing Jack the Ripper around the corner at every term. Everyone's suspecting everyone else, and there's all these different reports. And basically, what this newspaper's done is just mash them all up together. There's images of the police taking witness statements. There's images of the things people have witnessed. We have a version of Jack the Ripper. And at the bottom of the scene, we've got, well, an image that is subtitled Another Discovery in Whitechapel by a Dog. And it's a street scene, and there's many men, one who looks like he's holding a shovel, and some policemen, and they're pointing at something on the ground. The details of it, thankfully, are not very clear, but the insinuation is, of course, that it's a body, of one of the victims. And we get a sense of the absolute shockingness of this, I think, but also that it lends itself so well to narrativization. All of these little cartoon strip windows, they're like scenes in a graphic novel or a play. They feel theatrical. This is a story that, although it's presented almost as chaos, is absolutely being organized and narrativized in a really conscious way, I think. This is a story within a story.
Yeah.
The reporters are taking what they are hearing on the streets and they're making it into something else. They're reworking it for mass appeal and entertainment.
And this is part of a series, because if you just scroll down a little bit, there is another newspaper front page from a few weeks earlier in September, September 8th, I think, 1888, yes. And what we have in the middle of that section is another less chaotic scene, but very, very official heavy, shall we say. So we're seeing constables, we're seeing detectives, we're seeing committees and inquest of men, medical men, etc. meeting.
There's a lot of men in this image.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like predominantly men in this image. Then there's in the bottom left-hand corner of this bit, there's the finding of the body. So there's a policeman's torch shining a light on a woman who's on the ground. And then if you are aware of some of the post-mortem imagery, that the mortuary imagery, there is an image here that you will recognize as being definitely based on, this artist has definitely visited this body or else has seen the photo of the body, because it lines up with some of those photos that we know and that, as you described earlier, is available online.
And this is in this image, she's in a coffin.
Yes.
We can see that her throat has been cut, mm-hmm. and that obviously she's, you know, about to be laid to rest. But it's, and yeah, there's all these images of men, all the different characters. This is a cast of characters. These are the male heroes who are coming in, restoring order, investigating everything, because of course the Victorians love an investigation and they love an armchair investigation. They love to sit at home and read
part of it.
Yeah, exactly. And to feel that they can contribute something. And we know that people wrote in to the police detectives responsible for looking into these murders, and also to the newspapers to say, you've missed this incredibly important clue, or I have a theory, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, I know who
I know
who it was. It's my neighbour, or, you know, things like that. Something that I find interesting about this image is, so this paper, this is another illustrated police news, but it's dated to September 1888. So this is one of, I think this is the first victim, Marianne Nichols. And we see that it's starting to become a big story. It's the kind of central block of the images on the front page. It's alongside a host of other violent crimes. There's a scene at the top with a woman pushing a man out of what looks like a pub. And then at the top, it says to the other side, attempted murder and suicide in Wales. And there's a man bursting into a bedroom and shooting a woman with a pistol in bed. And then underneath it says, an entire family murdered. And there's a man riding by on horseback and he shot everyone. And then on the bottom left, there's another murder. So there's a sense that when the Whitechapel murders begin, yes, they are shocking, but they are very much part of a canon.
Sure.
In terms of media representation. And it's only when more and more bodies, when these women start to be found and discovered on the streets, that people start to really panic. And that's when the fever sets in.
And eventually it goes beyond that media focus. And eventually that, so you can definitely argue and very forcefully, I think, that this is already a level of exploitation. But that becomes more personalized, and individuals rather than these newspaper organizations start to try to capitalize on the deaths of these women, even within 6 months of them happening. And that brings us to the next part of our story. The following article appeared in St. James's Gazette on Wednesday, the 6th of February, 1889, approximately 3 months after the death of Mary Jane Kelly. At the Old Bailey yesterday, Thomas Barry was indicted for committing a nuisance by exhibiting figures illustrating the Whitechapel murders, and thereby causing idle people to assemble and remain in the Queen's Highway. The defendant occupied numbers 106 and 107 Whitechapel Road, where he carried on the business of a showman. And this case had been taken up from the inhabitants of the district complaining of the nuisance which his exhibitions caused. The exhibition consisted of waxwork figures and monstrosities of various kinds, and in the autumn of last year, the defendant added figures of the poor women murdered in Whitechapel. He sought to attract people by exposing a large picture outside the premises representing one of the mutilated victims, but the inhabitants became so indignant that they threatened to pull it down. Then a figure of Jack the Ripper was added to the show. A great deal of noise was created by the yelling and shouting, which went on to induce people to enter, and the result was that a vast number of disorderly persons assembled in front of the premises. There have been a number of robberies there. after the Whitechapel horrors ceased to attract, the defendant had a bearded woman who was half gorilla and half woman, a fat French woman 8 feet round the shoulders, and the female champion boxer of the world. A man named Lindley pleaded guilty to a similar offence committed in the same neighbourhood.
So we've just heard an extract from a Victorian newspaper, and the language is a little bit dense there. But essentially what I think we're dealing with is a man who has been brought up in court for setting up an exhibition of waxworks exhibiting the murders, a figure of Jack the Ripper. And the thing that people seem to have objected to is the shouting in the street, the drawing in of customers. This is a theatrical spectacle. And people in Whitechapel in this area are calling him out for it. It's hard to know where to start with this, isn't it? I mean, obviously, if you think about this waxwork attraction, there's the Whitechapel victims being put on display. And then later on, there's this bearded woman, there's a fat French woman and a female champion boxer. There's so much there about putting different types of women's bodies on display. And women who are living are put alongside depictions of women who have been murdered as equal commodities, oddities. It's very grim. I want to say something a little bit here as well about wax as a medium, because wax as a medium is so uncanny. It's lifelike. It can depict flesh like nothing else, actually. And we as human beings seem to be drawn on a morbid level to seeing the details of those injuries, to seeing what human beings can do to each other when it's played out in wax. And it feels like it's at least one step removed that we allow ourselves, and I'm using we very broadly here, I wouldn't go and necessarily look at this, but we allow ourselves to look at that without feeling that we are looking at the reality of it, the real violence.
Yeah, exactly. Somewhat kind of, for want of a better word, sanitized, I suppose. But it also, doesn't it?
Maybe not sanitized, but it's made palatable. It's made into entertainment.
Yeah. You're not on the cobbles looking at actual blood and you know that. But at the same time, you're getting
and therefore your moral responsibility is
diminished,
removed to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And of course, Jack the Ripper in this exhibition that's put on in, when's this, 1889, the year after the murders?
Well, 3 months after really, Mary Jane.
Let's just say, in the same community. These are people who've been traumatised and they're being re-traumatised.
By the way, he's taken up. It's reported 3 months after. So reckoning is it's happening while the murders are happening. Like, he has these wax figures brought in first when the murders are still unfolding.
I mean, that's not surprising, you know, given the very quick response of not only the police but the media to this. It's not surprising that human nature is to swoop in and make money off of this. So it wouldn't surprise me if that was going on at the same time. And that's so interesting because then you get the theatricality of the streets themselves. And, you know, people often talk about the Whitechapel murders in terms of that theatricality, that there is an argument to be made that the murders are very performative. The bodies are left in places to be found. Whether that is the reality of what the killer, whoever they were,
was thinking,
we don't know. And I'm not particularly interested. But there's a sort of mirror image theatricality happening here with a shop front with the waxworks and, you know, there's people out on the streets. And it seems to be, interestingly, not the exhibition of these waxwork victims that offends
not
people.
At all.
It's the nuisance that the business is making out in the streets, disrupting things. Yeah. You know, you think Jack the Ripper is disrupting the streets by meting out this violence on women and people are complaining about a little bit of shouting. It's fascinating. The other thing I suppose to say is that Jack the Ripper here, as a character, makes his appearance in wax. And of course, I think I'm right in saying that he's been in the Madame Tussauds. I don't know if he still is, but certainly he was. I remember going as a child. He was in the Chamber of Horrors with all, you know, Crippen and all the other famous serial killers. And let's be honest, celebrated serial killers, because that's what wax, as well as being this lifelike thing, it's a form of sculpture. It's making a statue, and statues really celebrate people. It elevates people. It's a way of remembering them and depicting them in a certain way that is attached to a certain kind of narrative. And that's what's happening here, that we've got come and look at the gruesome details of the injuries these women suffered and they're reduced to objects and things of curiosity. And then we've got Jack the Ripper, the character, come and meet the mysterious man. We have, this is as close as you're going to get in the flesh, you better hope, to this real person.
And it feeds into this Victorian freak show phenomenon that's happening kind of between the 1840s, right into the beginning of the first decades of the 20th century. But, and I think this is fascinating in this case, like, who is this aimed at? Because the freak show is aimed at, the organized freak show is aimed at the middling classes because they've got the money to spare on this. So this is not a middle class neighborhood. So I'm interested to know if people were, and we don't know the answer to this, but
people must have been coming in.
Yeah.
The beginnings of
while this was happening,
people are coming in and looking at this, surely.
And this is kind of one of the things I was not aware of, that this was, that there was an element of tourism and attraction growing up around these murders as they were unfolding. I didn't know that. And that's why when we stumbled across this, obviously we're not the first people to know about this particular display, but I didn't know about it, and I'm sure a lot of people don't.
So I had read about this before, and it's something that's always stuck in my mind. And I think it's partly because I'm interested in waxworks more generally, and I just think it's such a weird and fascinating medium that deserves more attention, really, as a strange art form and sort of cultural phenomenon. But it just seems, it's so obscene. It's so obscene. And it's really stuck with me. And I think it captures, like nothing else, the beginning of that celebration of Jack the Ripper and the entertainment value that people have found in these murders.
And not even past tense, right? People, murder is still big business. And again, you know, I think we have to be really present in our condemnation here, in that we present a show called After Dark and we talk about historic murder, and we try as much as we can to bring that element of historic analysis to it so that we're giving a context around these true crimes where people's lives were actually affected at the time. But there's obviously very modern iterations of that that are hugely popular on every platform that exists today. We are all complicit in this, and the kernel of the question for me is not necessarily a question of judgment of what these people are doing. But of course, it is not a very laudable thing that's happening. But the question for me is why? Why do we need to get close to these things? Why do we need to get as close as possible to these things? Because people say about it's something got to do with solving. I think that's an element. But it's also something I think got to do with being as close to the mystery of death as we possibly can be, and observing it when it's not directly on us.
I think for me, what the 1880s reaction and representation of these murders shows us is the origins of this treatment of the story that we are still dealing with today. We're still dealing with the fallout of this. And if you look at how Hallie Reubenhold's book has been received, on the one hand, it's been hugely praised, but she's also received so much abuse from people who don't want her to question the narratives that have been handed down to us by a Victorian press. And the fact that we're still having those arguments and we're still having to advocate for the basic dignity of these women, these five women, possibly more, who were killed by Jack the Ripper, and, you know, many, many women like them throughout history who've been killed in this way or who face domestic violence or, you know, violence of any kind. We're still having to deal with that. We're still debating it. Should it be a debate? I don't think so. I think it's kind of obvious where the moral line is, but apparently that's not necessarily the case. And I think it's important not to look away from this.
Yeah,
I think we should look at it with scrutiny. We should look closely at the details, not necessarily wallow in them, because it is grim and these were real human beings. But I think to turn our eyes away from this case, and including the women's murders, the moments of their murder, I think it's so important that we do that and that we take note of it and we look at how people reacted to it and how people continue to react to it.
I think that's a good place to leave it, because we're never going to solve this. And I don't mean the crime. I mean the ongoing cultural discussions, because they will also date. I think we need to be really aware of that. What we are talking about now won't be how people talk about this case, because they will still be talking about it in 50 or 100
years. It's an ongoing conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. This has been, as Maddie said at the beginning, one of the ones we've been intrigued to get into, because it's so multifaceted. It goes beyond the crimes, as we've been discussing, to just being this whole other thing unto itself, an industry in many ways unto itself. Do leave us a review. It helps other people find us. And until next time, we shall see you soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of After Dark. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcast. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour.
Don't forget, you can listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe.
And as a special gift, now don't say we never give you anything, you can also get your first 3 months for £1 a month when you use the code AFTERDARK at checkout.